the threat of nuclear war looms large.
Israel has never confirmed that it has nuclear weapons. And while analysts say Iran does not have them yet, it does have the expertise and the resources to make nuclear weapons.
President Volodymyr Zelensky unveils his so-called victory plan to the public.
He spoke at the Ukrainian parliament and announced a list of measures that, according to him, would turn the tide of the war with Russia in favor of Kyiv.
Plus, a deep dive into one of the most divisive issues in American politics.
This is the next important step for Nevada to protect reproductive freedom and particularly our abortion rights in this state.
Today is Thursday, October 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. We begin today in the Middle East, where tensions between Israel and Iran and Iranian proxy groups continue to rise as the world anxiously waits to see what Israel's promised retaliation for Iran's October 1st missile strikes will look like, sparking concerns of a nuclear confrontation. VOA's Heather Murdoch has the story from Istanbul.
Israel has never confirmed that it has nuclear weapons. And while analysts say Iran does not have them yet, it does have the expertise and the resources to make nuclear weapons. As the two countries face off in proxy wars in the region, Israel has warned its response to hundreds of Iranian missiles on October 1 will be deadly, precise, and surprising. Iran has vowed to counter any new attacks. Dr. Sanem Vakil is the director of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London.
This open conflict ultimately brings to the surface Israel's largest security problem, which is Iran's persistent adversarial relationship and supporting of the axis of resistance groups on Israel's border.
The term axis of resistance refers to Iranian-backed military groups that have historically called for the destruction of Israel, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, where more than 2,300 people have been killed and 1.2 million people have been displaced by Israeli attacks in recent weeks, and Hamas in Gaza. The widening conflict began when Hamas killed 1,200 people and kidnapped hundreds of others inside Israel in a surprise attack on October 7 of last year. Since then, the Gaza Health Ministry says more than 42,000 people have been killed, and almost the entire civilian population of the Strip has fled their homes. But experts say this does not mean the growing conflict will lead to nuclear war. This is Samuel M. Hickey, the Paul A. Castleman Policy Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C.
It's highly unlikely that either Israel or Iran would see a benefit in using nuclear weapons. Due to the catastrophic consequences that would really follow, right? Both countries understand that the use of nuclear weapons would invite massive retaliation, potentially leading to their own destruction.
Israel has said it will not target nuclear sites after much speculation by politicians and analysts on what Israeli forces will do next. Hickey says hitting Iranian nuclear facilities would not likely prevent Iran from developing a bomb.
You could continue to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, but the thing is, they would keep popping up in different places. They would go underground.
Attacks on nuclear facilities could blow radioactive materials into civilian areas, and it could encourage Iran to build nuclear weapons, even though Tehran has previously said it would not. Again, here's Dr. Vakil from Chatham House.
Israel's actions and the lack of diplomatic engagement to incentivize Iran to curtail or constrain its program could, over time, lead to the weaponization of Iran's nuclear program. And that, of course, would be disastrous for the broader region.
How much time it would take for Iran to build nuclear weapons has been the subject of much speculation. Hickey says Iran's so-called breakout time, or the time it would take for Iran to produce the fuel for a nuclear weapon, is about a week. But building a bomb, he says, would then take place in secret, with a secret timeline, and would likely take months, at least. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made public the details of the previously discussed victory plan during a speech in the Ukrainian parliament on Wednesday. The presentation takes place at a very tough moment for Ukraine as Russian forces continue to advance in the eastern front line. Anna Chernikova has the story from Kyiv.
After closed-door presentations to a number of Western leaders, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky finally presented his victory plan to the public. On Wednesday, he spoke at the Ukrainian parliament and announced a list of measures that, according to him, would turn the tide of the war with Russia in favor of Kyiv. During his speech, Zelensky said that in the future he sees Ukraine will be a strong part of the global world, be on an equal footing with all the leading countries, and be in the European Union as well as NATO. Zelensky's victory plan consists of five main points. The first point is to invite Ukraine to NATO in the short term. Kyiv discussed this point with its partners earlier, but has not yet received positive signals. The next main point is strengthening Ukraine's defense through allowing operations on Russian territory, shooting down Russian aircraft jointly with partners, expanding the use of Ukrainian drones and missiles, and lifting restrictions on the use of Western weapons, as well as access to partners' intelligence. Third is restraining Russian aggression. Ukraine proposes to host on its territory a comprehensive non-nuclear package to deter further Russian aggression. He did not clarify what exactly he meant. The fourth point is Ukraine's strategic and economic potential. Zelensky emphasized Ukraine is rich in natural resources. This is an opportunity for partners to work with Ukraine. Kyiv offers to sign agreements with the EU and the USA on joint protection and investment in the extraction and use of these resources. The fifth and final point is to be applied during the post-war period. The Ukrainian experience should be used as a model for the entire alliance and the defense of Europe. Zelensky goes so far as to suggest Kyiv replace the American military in Europe with Ukrainian after the end of the war. Zelensky emphasized that if Ukraine and its partners begin to implement this victory plan now, then in 2025 the war may be over. Political analyst Vitaly Portnikov notes that this plan is essentially a proposal to Ukraine's Western allies to support Ukraine during the term in office of the new US president. After all, 90% of the implementation of this plan depends not on Ukraine, but on the Western allies. Ukrainians received this plan quite ambiguously. Artem from Kyiv does not see the clear steps that will enable Ukrainian victory under this plan and emphasizes that this plan does not include army reforms, which he thinks is a key issue. Nina, also Kyiv citizen, says this plan is very optimistic and she wants to believe that it will be implemented. However, she says, there are not enough points on the responsibilities Ukraine takes to make it work. Mainly, the plan includes the responsibilities of the allies and additional aid they have to provide. According to the head of the Office of the President of Ukraine, Andriy Yermak, Kyiv expects feedback from partners in the near future. The presentation of Zelensky's victory plan takes place at a time when Russia continues to put pressure on Ukrainian cities and infrastructure, and Russian troops are advancing in the east towards the strategically important city of Pokrovsk. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
So, as we've heard, President Zelensky of Ukraine made the specifics of his victory plan public, but is it enough to win the war? For some analysis, I speak with Daniel Davis. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Army and a senior fellow at Defense Priorities. So, President Zelensky made his victory plan public today. Do you think it has a shot at working? Is it a good plan?
It's not a plan at all. It's complete fiction. It's bizarre. I mean, there's no kinder way to put it. When you see him talking about joining NATO as step number one, and then step number two is a strong self-defense that he said that he wants to invade more Russian territory. I mean, there is no military capacity to do any of those things. There is no prospect whatsoever that anyone in NATO is going to vote for having them to come into the alliance now or later. It's several that are outright opposed, like God of Hungary and Fico of Slovakia. And I doubt he would have any success with Erdogan out of Turkey, for that matter. So there is no prospect for any of that. But even if there was somehow political will in the West, there's no capacity for him to do any of that because their army continues to just suffer egregious and irreversible losses on the battlefield. And they just don't have enough ammunition, weapons, or personnel to stem the tide anywhere, much less ever reverse it. Jake Sullivan announced in Kiev just a month ago that we don't even have, the United States doesn't have enough air defense interceptor missiles to continue to support our existing. I think there's 17 customers that now we've told all of them, you're not going to get anything because we're giving it all to Ukraine. It's not enough. Secretary of Defense has said we don't have enough long-range missiles. Zelensky also wants permission to fire into Russia. You don't have enough of those either. So all in all, it is just a complete fiction to even think that it's possible.
So what is Zelensky's best choice going forward? What can he do?
Well, in my view, there's only one of two courses that you can choose. You can, number one, continue to ignore reality, continue fighting, and in which case you're going to get probably tens of thousands more of your people killed, lose more territory, have more of your cities destroyed, and in the end, be forced into a capitulation where you'll be given the surrender terms because you'll eventually lose. Russia is just too big and has too many resources, both human resources and natural resources, and they will eventually continue to win. Or you can do the only thing that makes sense at this point, which is to seek the negotiated settlement on the best terms available. But he forswore that because he said in his speech today that he would not give any territory to have negotiated settlement. But all he's doing, in my view, is condemning his side to a military loss if he stays with that course of action.
Daniel Davis is a senior fellow with Defense Priorities and host of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. Mr. Davis, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
The Coast Guard in Greece says that at least one man has died and another two are still missing after a wooden boat carrying 100 migrants sank. A total of 97 people were rescued by a passing cargo ship and were being taken to the island of Crete. The migrants came from Pakistan, Sudan, Bangladesh, and Somalia.
On Wednesday, Italy made it illegal to go abroad to have children through surrogacy. Opponents decry it as medieval and discriminatory to same-sex couples. Italians who break the law can face up to 2 years in jail and up to 1 million euros in fines. The measure was promoted by the far-right Brothers of Italy party led by Premier Giorgia Meloni, asserting that it protects women's dignity.
North Korea has confirmed its recently revised constitution defines South Korea as a, quote, hostile state for the first time. North Korea's rubber stamp parliament made the change last week, but state media hadn't immediately provided many details. In January, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un called for the constitutional change, designating South Korea as the country's main enemy and removing the goal of a peaceful Korean unification. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. I'll have a look at politics in Hungary in just a moment. First, though, Alexis Strop is here with our daily look at the U.S. presidential election.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court sent the issue of abortion back to the states in 2022, Democrats have mobilized to protect abortion rights while Republicans have worked to restrict the procedure. As the issue is motivating voters to go to the polls this year, VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson from the battleground state of Nevada.
This is the next important step for Nevada to protect reproductive freedom and particularly our abortion rights in this state.
Voters here in Nevada aren't just deciding between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris for president. They're also voting on question six.
Then we hope we vote yes on six. Thank you.
Laura Campbell is going door to door telling people why she thinks a yes vote on question six is so important. Campbell is the director of the National Organization for Women's Nevada chapter.
Abortion access actually saved my life more than once. And I just think it's important that after Roe v. Wade was overturned, that the state protects us.
But at an anniversary celebration for First Choice Pregnancy Services, a religious nonprofit providing alternatives to abortions, people like Deborah Costello are worried that question six will pass.
The fight could seem overwhelming. Millions and millions of dollars in our state supporting the abortion industry.
Nevadans already voted in 1990 to make abortion legal up to 24 weeks. But Democrats fear a second Trump presidency could overturn those rights, even though Trump says the issue should be left for each state to decide. If question six passes, the existing protections would become part of the state's constitution, making them even more difficult to remove.
I mean, we've seen lives are being lost across, 22 states have abortion bans, and we don't want that to happen in Nevada.
Jessica Ponce de Leon is a first-time U.S. voter. She planned to vote yes on question six and for Kamala Harris even before Campbell knocked on her door.
I don't think that the government should have any say over women's bodies or any of that. I definitely feel like women should have total control over their body.
Nevada is one of 10 states this election year to give voters the choice to decide how and when abortion should be legal. In past election years, putting that issue on the ballot has boosted voter turnout and benefited Democratic candidates up and down the ticket.
Christian Mersch, a Brazilian immigrant who got pregnant in an abusive relationship and chose to keep her baby, is a board member of Nevada Right to Life.
Without life, there's no liberty, there's no other rights. If you don't respect life, there's going to be racism, human trafficking, and I just feel that we're disposable right now.
While the issue is motivating young voters, first-time voter Emily Costello says minds can be changed, and not all young voters will vote for Democrats.
And if you can visually see how destructive that is to just a single human being, that'll change your mind instantly. Instantly.
A nationwide survey released this week by independent health polling source KFF says a growing number of women cite abortion rights as their top issue since Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee for president. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
From American politics to Hungarian politics, criticism is growing against Hungary's longtime leader, Viktor Orban, and so are questions about the future of his country's role in Europe. Hungary holds the EU presidency until the end of this year, and members of Hungary's rising opposition are accusing Orban of working to undermine Europe's security and unity. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze has more from Budapest.
Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is a vocal critic of European Union policies. Orban has delayed Sweden's NATO membership, vetoed aid to Ukraine, and since assuming the EU's rotating presidency in July, launched an unauthorized peace initiative for Russia's war in Ukraine. Orban's most recent call for a ceasefire in Ukraine prompted a swift response from the European Commission president.
The world has witnessed the atrocities of Russia's war. And yet, there are still some who blame this war not on the invader, but the invaded.
Ursula von der Leyen criticized Hungary for blocking aid to Ukraine, its close ties to China, and its continued reliance on Russian energy. At the Hungarian EU presidency office in Budapest, spokesman Zoltán Kovács called Brussels' policies toward Hungary hypocritical and politically motivated.
Political element is obvious. This is not a leftist liberal government. We are very outspoken conservatives with a different mindset, with a different political program, if you like.
Kovács said by criticizing the current government, the EU is also undermining the will of the Hungarian people. Meanwhile, a Transparency International report accuses Hungary's government of eroding democracy while benefiting from EU funds and enriching its allies through widespread corruption. Zoltán Tar, a Hungarian member of the European Parliament from the opposition Tisza party, says the Orbán government's actions are weakening the European Union.
For example, the close cooperation with Russia, the cooperation with China, the way it is being done, it is not helpful. It is creating a security risk.
He says that a member of the EU and NATO Hungary must adhere to their rules.
That was our choice. And that would mean that we follow the rules as well as we are not just taking the benefits of this membership. So for us, this is very important to be a faithful, honest partner.
Over the past year, Hungary's opposition has made significant gains with record high turnout. In this year's elections, the Tisza party secured 30% of Hungary's seats in the EU parliament, second only to Orbán's Fidesz party. András Rácz is a senior research fellow at the German Council on Foreign Relations.
There is a massive thirst for a change, I would say desire, and also a lot of dissatisfaction and anger vis-a-vis the government.
Rácz and others point out that in the 14 years that Orbán has been in office, Hungary has become the second poorest country in the European Union after Bulgaria.
It's also about the very material needs of the people who are looking for a change, hoping for a better life in the existential sense.
EU leaders and the opposition will have another opportunity to voice concerns about Hungary's future next month when the Hungarian Prime Minister hosts a summit in Budapest. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Budapest.
And finally, authorities in northwestern Nigeria say they are investigating the cause of a fuel tanker crash and explosion that killed at least 147 people and injured dozens more early Wednesday. It was Nigeria's second major tanker disaster in a month. Scott Walterman narrates this report from Timothy Abizu in Abuja.
The Jigawa State Police Command said it had launched an investigation into Wednesday's accident in the village of Majia. The police said the fuel tanker driver lost control of his vehicle and crashed after he veered off the road to avoid colliding with a moving truck. Officials say the accident caused fuel to spill out of the tanker, and within minutes, the gasoline ignited, causing an explosion. Dozens who were injured in the blast are receiving treatment at local hospitals. Jigawa State Police spokesperson Lewin Sisu Adam spoke to VOA via phone.
Quenched down by the effort of the fire service, and everything is calm. And they are currently, everybody is evacuated from the place now. Some of them are critically injured, while some are not severely injured like that, but they are receiving treatment at the hospital now. For now, the investigation is still ongoing about what caused the tanker to fall down, but the driver lost control.
Fuel tanker accidents are common in Nigeria, where most of the 50 million liters of gasoline consumed daily gets to gas stations and end users via poorly maintained roads. Nigeria's Federal Road Safety Corps says the country recorded more than 1,500 tanker accidents and 535 deaths in 2020 alone. Last month, 48 people were killed when another tanker overturned and exploded. Jigawa resident Abdullahi Yawali says it's the economic situation that pushes people to rush toward overturned tankers despite the danger.
People get their jerry can, they start taking the petroleum. And we are living in that critical condition in Nigeria. People are getting way to success, so that is why. And because, you know, if you take that petroleum, they will sell it. And there are many small boys that are not reach 10 years, 9 years, 8 years, that in that accident.
Fuel prices have jumped sixfold since President Bola Tinubu ended fuel subsidies last year. Jigawa state officials say they will try to dissuade citizens from scooping up fuel at tanker accident scenes, but until the citizens are less desperate, they may continue to risk it all. For Timothy Obiju in Abuja, I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for joining us.